BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Is sharing a video on BitTorrent like shoplifting from a movie store? Or is it like loaning a videotape to a friend? Is reloading a web page over and over again like a peaceful virtual sit-in or a violent smashing of shop windows? Is the freedom to connect like freedom of speech or like the freedom to murder?
Why would you bring a case against Aaron Swartz? He was not trying to steal money from anybody. He wasn't trying to defraud anybody of access to revenue. None of that. But he was an easy target. So that's why they would bring an action against him. And so to the extent the government says, trust us, there are endless instances where we would say, see, we trusted you and look what you did.
I'm Gabriella Coleman, and this is The Hackers, a series that delves into the hidden histories of hacking and uncovers how it shaped the world as we know it. In this episode, we're exploring the life and legacy of Aaron Swartz, whose death in 2013 transformed him into an icon of hacker culture. This is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Harvard, a founding member of Creative Commons, and described by The New Yorker as the most important thinker on intellectual property in the internet era.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you met Aaron?
I was giving speeches around the country, and Aaron, as a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, would be brought by his parents to these conferences. He was a very short, plump little boy back then. And he would raise his hand and ask the most penetrating questions of anybody in the room.
They later became friends, having been officially introduced by another member of the Creative Commons, Lisa Ryan.
I first knew Aaron on a mailing list about XML and RDF. And I had picked out Aaron on the mailing list. And it wasn't until both Lawrence Lessig and I had talked to him privately that we realized he was 14 years old. And he was still, as far as we were both concerned, the person that we wanted for the project.
Aaron was something of a tech prodigy and worked on the coding of Creative Commons, was involved in the development of the web feed format RSS, the open source movement, and was a co-founder of Reddit. Really, his fingerprints are all across the internet.
He's the kind of hacker that I like to call the Leonardo da Vinci brand of hacker. These people notice that there's a need for something and create something to make it better. He would see a situation like Google claiming copyright on their public domain book scans. So he went and downloaded them all and uploaded them to the Internet Archive, where they belonged, arguably.
But as he grew older, he became more of a political activist. And when Aaron was called by one of the people who was working on stopping SOPA,
the Stop Online Piracy Act,
he said, look, it's an impossible fight. And anyway, it's not really what I'm interested in right now. I'm interested in how do we get healthcare. But he was convinced that this was an important fight to take up, even though it didn't seem like you could win it.
Because this isn't a bill about copyright, about the freedom to connect. That this bill would let the government devise a list of websites that Americans weren't allowed to visit.
There were multiple campaigns and protests against the bill.
One of those campaigns was Internet Blackout Day, where all sorts of entities basically for one day shut down access to their sites on the internet to get people to tell Congress to stop this crazy bill. The phones melted on Capitol Hill. And almost overnight, the bill went from being supported by practically everybody in Congress to being opposed by practically everybody in Congress.
After all this, we had won. The thing that everyone said was impossible. We did it. They killed the bill dead.
This was a major political victory spearheaded by a hacker. But it came when Aaron was under investigation by the U.S. justice system for some of his previous projects.
Could you take us through the legal case that was used against him in 2011?
There was a information service called JSTOR, which has an extraordinary archive of academic articles. And the question was raised, why isn't JSTOR available, at least to the developing world, for free? Why should people in malaria countries have to pay money to learn about how best to deal with the threats of malaria? Why isn't this available for free? And there was a question asked about how much it would cost to make the JSTOR archive available freely, was some unbelievably large number, tens of millions, maybe $100 million.
This outraged Aaron, and he began a project to make this work freely available, believing people had a moral imperative to unshackle the privatization of knowledge.
He was at the time a fellow in the center I was running at the Ethics Center at Harvard. He went to MIT. MIT has a policy, or at least at that time had a policy, which said that anybody on the campus is free to use MIT's access to the internet.
He set up a JSTOR account and created a script to grab articles en masse.
And then he attached a hard drive to his laptop. And then he used an Ethernet cable, a very important point, to plug into the MIT network in an open computer closet. And then he just left his computer there to download stuff.
At some point, MIT discovered the computer sitting in an unlocked closet. So they set up a sting operation where they had a little camera set up.
Aaron knew the cameras were there. He sort of sheepishly looks at the camera and turns his face to the side. I think he's smiling, because why is somebody putting a camera in the open computer closet?
One day, as he was heading home, the Cambridge police arrested him.
We have a video of him talking to the officer that's behind the glass, and he's asking him what this is about.
He was charged with violating the CFAA, though he insisted he was innocent of any crime.
And the U.S. attorney had a press conference and declared that they were going to send Aaron to jail for at least 25 years for what he had done, which was an astonishing statement.
Here in the United States, you could indict a ham sandwich. They didn't have any evidence, but they really wanted him to do prison time as an example.
The longer he tried to negotiate, the more aggressive the U.S. attorney got. And so finally, he was about to go to trial.
And he was really terrified of the government harassing his friends and family like they'd been harassing him.
Either he would win, and then he would have spent all of the resources that he had earned to defend himself, or he would lose and he would be in jail. Those options were extraordinarily depressing to confront, and unfortunately, those of us around him didn't quite see how depressing they were, because in early January, he took his life.
He was 26 years old.
I was in Mexico when I got the call, and I remember one of the things I was thinking about was, would anybody even notice? Because, you know, Aaron Swartz was not somebody who had ever been on national television. He was, as far as popular media goes, completely invisible. And so I thought, you know, maybe people wouldn't even realize that he's gone. But then I opened up my computer and I began to see hundreds of thousands of people who were so moved and angry and wailing at what we had lost.
It turned out there were people all over the world that he had helped. We learned about this a lot during his memorial. All the different people who had these little pages prepared that they wanted to share. Aaron was like this fairy that went around the world and helped people with their projects. He would get excited about something they were doing, and there was something specific that he knew about that he thought would help them. And they would go to the library or go to a conference room somewhere. Sometimes they're in the middle of a park for 8 hours. And he would fix whatever needed help with their project, make it better, and flutter away. And they would never see each other again in person. But he would usually continue to help them with their project as time went on.
Along with the outpouring of grief, many felt Aaron's case should have never happened.
If you go onto a website, so let's say a dating site, and it says, how old are you? And you're 40, but you say, I'm 35. And when it asks what your weight is, you say, I'm 175, when in fact you're 190. Well, those misstatements might be contrary to the terms of service to that website. What the government said is that if you violate the terms of service of the website, you have violated the law. So you commit a felony when you lie about your weight. And basically, that's the type of felony which they alleged Aaron had committed. JSTOR said that he shouldn't have been downloading in bulk the documents. Okay, so he might have been violating the terms of service. At most, he should have been punished by saying, okay, you violate our terms of service. Here's the penalty for that, whatever it would be. But the penalty would not be, as they were threatening, 25 years in jail.
In 2021, the scope of the law that was used to prosecute Aaron was curtailed due to a Supreme Court case, Van Buren versus the United States.
The person who was being charged had gained access to information for a purpose that was not legal. It was a police officer who gained access to information about driver's licenses for purposes that were illegitimate. And so the question was, did he violate the CFAA because he used the computer contrary to the rules that the computer set for how it was to be used? And what Amy Coney Barrett said on behalf of the Supreme Court is that the mere fact you violate the rules the computer might set doesn't mean you violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. To violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you must gain access to the computer by hacking into the computer. So that means that even if Aaron had violated the rules JSTOR had set, that doesn't mean that Aaron had committed a felony.
After Aaron's death, Lisa co-founded Aaron Schwartz Day, which later also included an annual hackathon. The aim was first to uncover what had happened to Aaron and then to carry on the projects that were to be his legacy. She was also keen to dispel some of the myths that have grown up around what happened to him.
So the one narrative that I actually didn't crush until last year was this idea that he had somehow died for the freedom of information. And this is really a myth that makes our skin crawl. Aaron didn't do anything so information could be free. Aaron did stuff so people could be free.
Every year at the hackathon, people come together to share and develop open source projects. Some of them include projects Aaron had been working on prior to his death, including one called SecureDrop that was created with Kevin Polson, a journalist at Wired.
They wanted to make a secure upload system. WikiLeaks was there for people to upload if you just wanted to just throw everything out there. But, you know, leaks are a mixed bag. So Aaron felt that it was better to get that information straight to journalists. And then journalists could write articles about it and not necessarily know where they got the documents from.
It means journalists can't be pressured to give up a vulnerable source.
And now it's literally used by every single reputable journalistic organization on the planet. And it's actually an open source project that anyone can work on if they would like to. And it's all inspired by Aaron's legacy and Aaron's vision that this was something that people would need.
What do you think Aaron's place is in hacker history?
Aaron would embrace the label of a hacker and understand that to be someone who uses skill to advance values he would defend and that most of us would also defend. And in that hacking, he helped people see ways that we could make the world function better. You know, there's something powerful about this mindset, the mindset of the engineer, the optimizing engineer. And I think what Aaron embodies is the idea of a hacker who constantly challenged himself and everybody around him to live up to those values.
Make no mistake, the enemies of the freedom to connect have not disappeared.
If you have an idea that you think can fix something that needs fixing in the world, just go do it. Don't let anybody say that you can't have an effect on the world because you're too young or too this or too whatever. Just go find the people that will help you have an effect on the world. And that's why we have Aaron Schwartz Day, because we want to be there to help people when they want to make things better.
If we let them persuade us, we didn't actually make a difference. If we start seeing it as someone else's responsibility to do this work, well then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
From the makers of The Battersea Poltergeist, a new podcast series for BBC Radio 4, Uncanny.
Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
Have you seen one?
Yes.
Real-life stories of the supernatural, told by the people they happen to. Presented by me, Danny Robbins.
There was a very strong sense of pure evil.
Subscribe to Uncanny on BBC Sounds.